Chapter 9. The man they called Alchemist was a former captain in the Special Air Service who had thought to better himself by transferring to the Royal Marines. He had served and fought in many parts of the globe, a brave and skillful soldier, trained to within an inch of his life. However, less than a year after completing his service and coming up against the civilian experience, he developed a chip on his shoulder that threatened to become a deformity. True, he had tried to sign on for a further 5 years, but this had been denied him. In reality, the events of the last decade of the century opened several dangerous man-traps for anyone like Alchemist. The fall of the Soviet Empire and its aftermath had caused this man's early retirement during the downsizing of NATO forces. A grave miscalculation had been made, and that, combined with individual concerns for the future, led many men and women to leave the armed services of their own accord. This, in turn, caused a knock-on effect. Manpower in all forces dropped to a dangerous level. So, less than a year after Alchemist left the Royal Marines, there were moves to bring back recently retired personnel so that the Royal Corps could be restored to full strength. Alchemist was not even offered a chance to return, and this certainly angered Richardson, for that was his name, pushing him almost to the edge of obsession. If Tessa Murray had known the full story of Ronald Brinsley Richardson, she would certainly have asked him about her former lover, her first true lover. The man whose real name, she'd been told, was Ralph Docking. She also knew that Docking was a Marine, and had she asked Ronnie Richardson, he would have told her everything about Captain Docking, R.M., but she did not know Ronnie, do or die Ron, as he was sometimes known to officers in other ranks with whom he had served, was a former Royal Marine. So she did not ask him. Tess Murray assumed he was SAS, and he admitted to it. So that was all one, as Shakespeare would have said. Richardson had first conceived the idea of assassin for hire long before he completed his service with the Royal Marines. The idea first came as a glimmer in his mind when he served on detachment to the Group, as 14 Intel was known, that most covert of military intelligence-gathering units, operating just under the surface in the north of Ireland. Even during the long and complicated series of truces toward the end of the millennium, at first sight it seemed to him a possibly astute career move, particularly in the light of his self-knowledge. Killing had never worried Richardson, while his advanced standard of covert fieldcraft and the use of small arms gave him every possible requirement for the job. Also, he was blessed, or cursed, with an uncanny talent for making himself visible or invisible at will. To those who eventually hunted him across Europe and the Middle East, Richardson seemed to have the expertise of a medieval magician, for he appeared to possess the ability to pass through locked doors and solid walls. He was also a master of that dubious special forces art, silent killing, which combined with the other skills made him a formidable enemy. In many ways, Alchemist was a man born out of his time. If he had reached maturity in the earlier half of the previous century, there would have been plenty of opportunities to indulge his lethal talents. Major wars are the workplaces of men and women with an aptitude toward murder. When Richardson first toyed with the idea of committing himself to the life of a serial assassin, it was simply a mental exercise, academic, a series of brain-cudgeling mind-twisters, dealing with abstracts that could never become realities, because there was no possibility of ever moving into the realms of fact. Until he actually did it. After that happened, it soon became clear that he truly liked the planning, the careful working out of the logistics, and the design of battle, particularly when the kill was to be in Europe. As an adolescent, he'd grown up in rural Berkshire, in a tiny village, a Roman Catholic enclave, the people of which seemed to be frozen in time with their faith. So his favourite memories were of the rolling downs, the endless cornfields, woods, and copses of his youth. His pleasures were simple, watching badgers, otters, foxes, and other wildlife, smelling grass after rain, trees and wildflowers at dusk on a hot summer's day, biting into a stripped corn husk, or seeing the sharp grey and white picture of a bitter winter evening, with smoke rising straight up from cottage chimneys. Even his first recollections of sex were locked into fields, woodlands, or hedgerows. His contemporaries all carried out their initial navigation around lithe, warm teenage bodies in the open. Not for them the back seat of a car or the parents' front room. Like his friends, Richardson explored the mounds and curves, the paradoxically firm and yielding flesh, under blue Sunday afternoon spring and summer skies, or hard by an early evening hedgerow. His first woman was had on springy turf deep within a wood, close to a rushing stream. When the girl cried out as he entered her, and again on reaching her first climax, he heard also the wind soughing in the trees and the trickling bubble of water over rocks. For Richardson, the alchemist, a walk in the fields could bring him face to face with sexual thoughts. Trees and running water would arouse him as easily as a glimpse of thigh, or the imagined fantasy of flesh moving under thin clothing. Like so many daydreams, the plans for a kill remained for years only in the mind. That was until Richardson met McLean, accidentally, or so it seemed, in the Savoy's American bar. They were both in London, staying at the same hotel. Jim McLean wanted some cigarettes. Ron Richardson was waiting for a girl. The pair of them were there together in the bar just after it opened. One of those rare coincidences where truth is stranger than fiction. Richardson quickly discovered that McLean was a successful lawyer, specializing in British tax law, and Richardson presented himself as a creator of adventure stories, historical empire soldiery yarns, and similar writing-by-numbers pastimes. McLean knew intuitively that this was a front. Sixth Sense was possibly the most important piece of glue that finally bonded the pair. He let Richardson run on for several minutes, then, "You haven't actually had a book published, have you?" Speaking in almost a whisper, looking slant-eyed at Richardson, who sipped his drink and did not return McLean's questioning glance. "Well, possibly not, but I'm working on it. I do have this great idea." Richardson shifted in his chair, elegant in an Armani suit, showing almost an inch of cream cuff and links made from a pair of antique gold coins. There was never anything cheap about Ronnie Richardson. The smile was devastating as he went on to describe the premise of his book. A man not averse to killing, with experience in special forces, hires himself out to ideological terrorist organizations. "He would take the heat," he explained, lighting a cigarette and ordering another round of drinks using only body language. "He'd slot only the truly difficult ones." For slot, read kill. SAS speak. "You really think they'd pay him to do that?" "If they have access to money, yes. You've got to remember that terrorists are your basic amateurs. There are targets they don't even attempt because they appear impossible. Targets they'd love to take out. Look at the times they've cocked up real spectaculars. I don't call Pan Am 103 or Oklahoma amateur cock-ups." "I do. Neither was surgical. There's nothing professional about big bomb jobs, nothing sophisticated about them. They're catch-all operations that don't require real skill. And you're an assassin, it'd be a professional." "Of course, a highly trained professional soldier can do the impossible and get away with it." Jimmy McLean appeared to think for a long time before he replied, "Only if he's exceptional and has the right intelligence." "Goes without saying," Richardson volleyed back. "You can't do anything like this without detailed intelligence. Watchers up close, on the ground, listeners, recorders, photographers, map makers even. But you'd have to test it against real life. No good writing a thick-eared novel, unless it bears some examination when set next to truth. Unless it's based on reality. Could it happen, do you think?" McLean sounded truly convinced, which was a plus. "I intend to find out. I propose to write the book. Live it, maybe."